You're listening to Going Native. It's our segment of the Zesty Garden where we talk about native drought-tolerant plants. And today it's Zauschneria. And one of the names I heard when I was first looking into native and drought-tolerant plants was fire chalice. And it happens to be a Utah's choice plant. And we're going to talk about two different ones, orange carpet and Wasatch fire. And if you want a plant to attract hummingbirds and to give you color until late in the season, this is one of those.
This is a great plant. It's easy to grow, native along the foothills here in the Wasatch and other places in the West. There's a couple cultivars that have been introduced that we're using a lot rather than the straight species. One of them is called orange carpet, and it's more of a ground cover type.
It's plant, a low growing
and spreading with underground runners, which is really interesting in as much as the species typically you don't notice any underground runners. And then there is a more mounding form that USU has developed. Some of the researchers down in Kaysville have developed. It's a selection. When I say they've developed, that's not accurate. It's a selection, meaning as you observe plants of a particular species and you see one that for some reason is different, has different characteristics, you select it or pull it away from the others and then continue to watch it, propagate it, and decide if those characteristics stay true. And if they do, then you can say, aha, I've got a new plant. And you call it a cultivar, which means cultivated variety. And so Wasatch Fire is a cultivated variety that the fellows down in Kaysville at the botanical gardens there have then selected and have named.
So the Wasatch Fire is going to be more of a specimen type plant, more on its own, where the orange carpet is going to spread.
That's right. So the Wasatch Fire might be 15 or 18 inches tall, 18 inches or 24 inches across, still having that same scarlet red, scarlet orange, depending on how your eye sees it, flower color, all of August, September, into October, till finally the weather says goodbye to it.
And tubular flowers?
Tubular flowers, almost penstemon-like, if our listeners know penstemons. Hummingbird friendly. In fact, one of the common names in addition to fire chalice is called hummingbird fuchsia, even though it's not a fuchsia or even remotely related.
But it has kind of fuchsia-like blossoms as well.
Yes, it has similar to that, yeah. So hummingbird fuchsia is another common name. They will take water in the garden or not. So if you're in a moderately watered garden, they'll be fine. Less water, they're happy. Lots of water, they're not happy.
With the orange carpet, can it be invasive at all?
I have seen stands of orange carpet that are bordering on invasive, which just is bizarre if you know this plant, because the species doesn't do that. But this cultivar, this orange carpet, can be quite vigorous. And when we say invasive, sometimes it scares us. But sometimes we've got a spot that we say, go, run. We want some growth there in that bed. And
this is going to be one of those.
It's going to be one that'll do that. Yeah.
Now, with the Wasatch Fire, are the blossoms any larger or smaller, or they just grow, the plant itself just grows smaller?
The plant habit is mounded, so it's got a nice mounding habit. And the Kaysville Botanical Garden people who have developed this have said it's long-blooming, strong-blooming, just a nice addition to the Zauschneria stable, so to speak.
Sun requirement?
Sun, part sun. I've seen it listed as part shade. I just don't see that unless it's just slightly filtered, but sun part sun would be its happiest places.
And plant it where you don't, you know, you have to get it established,
but
afterward, just whatever water it gets from Mother Nature is enough.
It can go on Mother Nature, or it can be in a garden with moderate water, but not lots.
Does it need to be cut back at all?
You would only cut it back in the fall or spring when, you know, in the fall when it's done, you say, I'm cleaning my garden now, or in the spring, because you didn't do it in the fall, you can clean it then. But typically, you probably wouldn't prune it in the summertime. Now, I need to do a disclaimer on this plant. Its foliage is not the most attractive. I'm not saying it's ugly, but it's not the most attractive. You're growing this for those scarlet, tubular flowers, August, September, October.
And there's so many of them, you're not really looking at the foliage anyway.
There are so many flowers, yeah. They are just absolutely loaded. Hummingbird friendly, you know, in a serious way. Bees as well, because it's blooming into October and there's less things in bloom then.
And soil requirements?
Anything. It can take sandy soil or clay soil. Probably the soil it likes the least is organic soil that we've kind of, you know, made ourselves, or with, you know, that we've, you know, not too much compost, you know.
Okay.
Less compost.
And how far south?
This plant grows, this genus grows Utah, Arizona, Nevada, California. There are plants in this genus. So it would be tolerant, even the species that are from colder climes. The genus as a whole would be tolerant in warmer climes. So if you were to be in St. George, for example, it would be fine.
Oh,
it would do fine. Even though this species might be from, you know, colder spot. But
So it just has a wider a range to adapt
to. Wider distribution, yeah.
Okay.
Natively.
Well, great. We've been talking about Zochneria. It is also known as Fire Chalice, and we've talked about two particular cultivars, Wasatch Fire and Orange Carpet. And Barney Barnett has been in studio with me. He's co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard. Barney, thanks for coming in.
Okay, thank you, Brian.
It's Bug Bites. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me is Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, and our word of the day is melissopalynology.
Very good.
I want to say that again, melissopalynology. It just kind of rolls off the tongue.
You did a great job.
What is melissopalynology?
So it's an approach or a study to determining what species of pollen are contained in honey or are on honeybees that they're carrying to the hive. And so this is used to be able to determine what source of flowers were used to make the honey. So if on the label of the honey it might say, pure clover honey or some other kind of flower name that the company needs to be able to show that that's actually the kind of flowers that were used to make the honey or the predominant type. I'm sure there's some regulations about what percentage it has to be. So it's been used mostly as a study to help combat honey fraud. So people claiming that it's clover honey or some other kind of honey, strawberry flower honey, when indeed it's not.
And so how is this research conducted? I mean, I'm imagining that the bees, they go out and how do they know what type of flower what's best for the hive?
So that's an interesting question. I don't know that entomologists or apiculturalists, those who work with honeybees in particular,
there's another word.
fully know all the reasons why bees pick certain flowers. We do know some of the reasons. So bees will have different needs in the hive to make the food, the larval food, to make the honey, to, you know, meet all the needs of the colony, to make the food for the queen. They need different kinds of components. And so the two main things that they use are, as we well know, pollen and nectar. But interestingly, they may not always get the pollen from the same flower sources that they get the nectar from. They may, but they may not. They may have certain foraging trips where they're very focused on just collecting pollen, and other certain foraging trips where they're just focused, the bee foragers are just focused on collecting nectar. And so they'll be selecting different flowers, different plants, based on what their priorities are, what their needs are in the hive
at that particular time.
And there are certainly trends or cycles where, like, even within a 24-hour period, there can tend to be, I may have this backwards, but I think it's more pollen collecting in the morning and more – no, I think I got it backwards. I think it's more nectar collecting in the morning and pollen collecting later in the day.
And that would make sense because there would be more moisture in the morning from overnight.
When the flowers first open up, they tend to have more nectar in them, and so the bees are going to be more focused on collecting nectar at that time. And then later in the day, they can go back and get pollen, which doesn't tend to – amounts of it don't tend to vary as much throughout the day. But in this particular study, they were looking at how they can tell what kinds of pollen are on a bee. And the traditional way that it's been done, and I've been able to actually watch scientists do this here at our own USDA bee lab, which is here in Logan, is they'll harvest pollen off of honeybees, or in this case, they're often working with native bees. But in the case of honeybees, they carry it in these little buckets basically on their hind legs, and they'll scrape it out of those corbicula and put them on a microscope slide with some kind of glycerin or other kind of moisture, put a slide cover on it, and then they'll have to go through, and they have some kind of grid on their slide, and count how many grains of the different shapes and sizes they see in that particular pollen load. And it's very tedious. First of all, the scientist has to learn, often even graduate students do this, they have to learn what do the pollen grains look like for the main flower species that we know our bees around here collect pollen from. So first you have to become trained in that. And then it's very tedious to go through the sample and count and sort each one. So this particular new method, which is why it's so exciting, is they're actually using the DNA of the pollen.
It's a barcoding.
To tell them as a barcode, basically saying, what was in here? Like you run it across your scanner at the cashier. The one downside they do point out is that it doesn't tell you how much of the different kinds there are. So to be able to know that these, you know, this 8 species of flowers were found in this pollen sample, but to know how much of each one, you would need to also combine that with some kind of actual pollen grain counting to know. But still, it's a way to greatly speed up the process, speed up the accuracy of the process. And the other little fun tidbit that they pointed out was that it's nothing like trying to get your research organism, in this case the honeybee, to do the work for you. So they're out there doing the sampling, visiting the different flowers, collecting the pollen, and then all you have to do is come back, scrape it off, run it through your little DNA barcoding, and voila, you've got an answer, and you didn't even have to go out there and sample the flowers yourself.
So the bees are the research assistants.
Exactly. These are the new students. I wonder if we need to put them on the student payroll.
I'm guessing they're probably not going to get paid very much.
They're not.
Yeah.
They're happy just for their honey in their hive.
Well, this is really kind of fascinating, and I love the photo on the front of this showing all the pollen covering the head of the bee. This is Pollen DNA Reveals Honeybee Foraging Habits, and we get a lot of our information from Entomology Today. They have, you could subscribe, just go to entomologytoday.org, and in the upper left corner of their main page, it's subscribe and receive new posts by email. And you get these about one every other day, I think is how it's been working out, and it's just something fascinating about the life and the research of insects.
It's really fun. As you mentioned earlier, you can easily get addicted to reading these.
Oh, it's one of the first things I read every day. Diane, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks.
You've been listening to Bug Bites. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. Welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's extension vegetable specialist. I did have an onion question. A guy that I know that lives around the corner from me wanted to know when to harvest his onions, and I said, well, how big are they? And he said, well, they're pretty good size. We planted the small plants, and they've gotten really big. Well, you can eat them now if you want.
Exactly.
But he was thinking as far as storage, and I told him, Well, if you're looking for storage, leave them in the ground until the tops die back, because the tops hadn't started to die back yet. And since you're looking more like
we see most of the time the earliest ones, some of the transplanted onion plants, they'll start senescing off and the tops will start dying back in early August to mid-August. But, you know, if you've got bulbs that are, you know, 2 inches in diameter, and you're buying your onions, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So, you know, go out and help yourself and use some of those. And I always find anyway that the transplanted ones don't store nearly as well. So, you know, they kind of are the filler. So, you know, you're done with whatever you stored from last year. May is kind of this period where I don't have many onions, but starting in June and then into early July, now they're starting to size up. Mm. You're thinning in June, I always say. You thin onions in June for your green onions, and then in July you're starting to bulb onions up, and then you start using those for your salads and your hamburgers or your whatever, tacos or whatever you're needing your onions for, and you're kind of working your way into that transplanted crop, and then they get bigger and bigger as the months go on, and then you start storing things in August, and then your main storage crop is really ready in September. So, yeah, if they're ready, start using them. Don't wait.
But just look for the tops to die back before you think about
trying to store them. That's right.
And so how far do you let them die back?
Well, I like to, you know, when they start to fall over, they're really at an appropriate size to dig up if you need to. You could let them the tops completely dry out in the soil. But what often happens is they're in the garden. We continually watering our other plants in the garden.
And they get watered as well.
And then they start storing too much of that water in the bulb. Or we introduce, there's some diseases. One of them that's really bad is botrytis bulb rot. And that occurs because we water and the plant is really well hydrated. So I like to see them when about half of the tops on your planting have fallen over, or maybe 70% of the tops have fallen over. Then just kind of roll them down. But then you need to stop watering them too.
At that
same time. Because what that does is that helps dry out that outer skin or that outer scale leaf. And that is a leaf that's so important to helping keep the moisture in the bulb. And so if you keep watering, it doesn't really dry out very fast, and you just introduce other diseases, and then they never store very well either. And so I often tell people just when they get about 70%, you know, the easiest thing to do is pull them up and move them out of the garden to some place where they can kind of naturally dry out. You don't want to kind of lay them out just in the sun to do that, because you'll get some sunburn on them, but put them in a shady area or so, or take all the tops and roll them over top of the plant so that the bulb is protected. And that's another way to do them. Then you could leave them right in the garden.
Dan, thanks for coming.
As always, it's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist and is in the first Thursday of every month. So he'll be back in August. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me today is Grant Carden, USU Extension Soil Specialist. And we're going to talk about vermicomposting. And that would be
using worms. Getting the worms to work for you. That's
okay.
Right.
So I'll start the conversation with, I've never done it before, but I was at a friend's home in Cedar City first part of November. And as they left their extended gift, because I was kind of excited about his composting, what he's doing in the back, he gave me a plastic grocery bag full of red worms.
Little wigglers, yeah.
Yeah, and so I've had them for, you know, I probably haven't taken care of them as well as I should have. They're still in the house. I still give them some food, but every once in a while I'll go a couple of weeks and go, oh, wait a minute, I've got worms. So I've got some plans for them outside, but it's amazing what they've been able to do as far as putting some table scraps and things in with them.
Right.
So thank you, Denny and Gail, for those those red worms. And so let's talk about vermicomposting and the advantages of using them. Now, these aren't the big red the brownish kind red the buff, night crawlers.
The earthworms that we all know and love, you know, in our yard and things like that, they tend to favor soil materials over the raw waste types of materials. So they're a different kind of worm. But these red wigglers that you talked about, they're kind of the most common ones that are used. And they can process quite a bit of vegetable matter waste, you know, cull vegetables, peel, the leftover lettuce and those kinds of things that you have regularly in your kitchen. There's some nuances to doing it with worms that we don't have that typically if you're composting regularly out in the yard, you know, just in the bins and things like that, because you have to maintain conditions that favor the growth of the worms so that they can process. Like you said, you know, you're putting in stuff every couple of weeks and, you know, they're not maybe doing as well as they could. The rule of thumb is, you know, you spend about a week or so gathering your waste, figuring how much you generate as a family, and then you typically will prepare a compost bin with about a pound of worms per half pound of food waste that you generate. And when we're talking about food waste, we're talking about things that come from plants. You don't want to put animal wastes, waste meats or vats or other things in that, but vegetable matter. You prepare these bins in the bottom with a bedding material that is organic also. Think shredded newspaper. A lot of people will use...
How do they usually come? I mean, can you buy them?
You can, you'll order them.
Locally, or do you order them through the mail?
You'll order them through the mail typically. There might be, I'm not aware of any sources locally for them, except for ordering through some of the nurseries and garden stores and things like that. But they'll come packaged, you know, in a refrigerated container kind of thing so that they're kept alive. And you can order as many pounds of them as you wish. But you joke about getting some from your friend, if you've got conditions right for them and you feed them regularly and they're working regularly, they'll double in their population every 3 to 4 months. And so you'll have to find some way of either increasing the number of bins you're using or, you know, sharing them with your friends.
So when they arrive in the mail, we just put them into this a dampened shredded newspaper.
Right.
You don't want it too wet, obviously.
No, you want it moistened to about the consistency of a wrung out sponge. And, you know, there's still quite a bit of water, as you know, in a sponge that way. You don't want it too wet because you want oxygen transfer in and out of the material. And you don't want to over wet it and cause, you know, anaerobic conditions in there for the worms. But the bedding material can be shredded newspaper, shredded cardboard cartonage. People use coconut fiber and other things, you know, that they'll use in there and soak it up. That's just kind of where they will hang out for the most part until you put the food scraps in on top of that. And then they'll begin to come up into that for active feeding. And they'll feed pretty rapidly on the waste material that you put there. But you want to make sure that you maintain moist conditions without overwetting things. You want to make sure that the temperature is in kind of their range of real activity, and that's typically anywhere from about 60 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit. And
so they like a little bit warmer than night crawlers.
And to stay that way, they really, a lot of people say, well, if I get too many of them, I can just put them out in the yard. And that's fine for a while in the summer and spring and early fall, but they really don't tolerate the winter time cold conditions that we get in our soils around here. So they'll die off over time and be outcompeted with the other earthworms that are already there. But, if you maintain conditions in that kind of their range, they'll go to town. They'll process that material within a few weeks, that you put in. And then you can regularly kind of then separate from the material that's there these decomposed, what we call worm casts or vermicasts, which is the processed waste through the gut of the worm. Now, in order for them to completely digest the material, since they don't have teeth and other things, they also encourage you to put some grit of some sort in there, cornmeal, a little bit of soil. I've seen really, really fine crushed eggshell used, and things like that, so that they can use that as kind of a grinding mechanism in their gut to to process the material.
Would you put
material.
Any fine sand in there? Is that too big?
No, soil materials, anything really fine would be fine to put in there. Not a lot, but a little bit there that they can accumulate in their gut and use that to help kind of grind.
Kind of like a chicken.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I order my chickens through the mail too.
Well,
so
yeah, you'll hear the digestive system of a worm kind of referred to as the crop and the gut and things like that, just like you would in a chicken. But so you regularly separate out what's there, and you can take that material and use it directly in the garden or in your potted plants or whatever you wish as it's processed.
And I've heard it's great stuff to use, not only to improve the tilth of the soil, but just some of the fertilizer that's available to plants.
Right. The typical analysis on the vermicasts that come out of that material is that the, you know, compared to yard waste compost that you do in the backyard, it's oftentimes, you know, 2 or 3 times higher in total nitrogen, as many as 7 times higher in actual available, readily available soluble nitrogen. Higher in typically phosphorus and potassium as well, and pretty equivalent in all the other nutrient levels compared to other compost types. So, you know, it really gives you a boost in terms of nitrogen and other things. It's really good for that. And so
really in your house plants, you could use it in your house.
Exactly, as a supplemental nutrient source for those. And like you said, it continues to break down. It is still organic material. It's only partially decomposed and by the worm, and so it'll provide a lot of the building blocks for structure in soils and additional organic matter in whatever setting you're using it.
Should I continue not only to put in the table scraps, the vegetative scraps, but should I continue to add things like some shredded newspaper, some other cellulose material?
Yeah, you'll refresh the bedding and things like that. You know, as these populations increase, you're going to have to kind of, you know, expand the apartment or, you know, add additional layers in a bin or additional bins. And so when you do those separations like that, then, yeah, replenish your bedding material, bring it up to the right moisture if you need to. A lot of times, and people will comment on this all the time with regular composting, they'll notice that they use kitchen waste, vegetable matter and things like that, that you get a lot of moisture out of that. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as those cells break apart, you know, the plant materials that are in there are 60-70% water. And so as those cells break apart and you begin to decompose that material, all that water then is released to the substrate. It'll percolate down through the material and things like that as well. So it's a good idea in these bins to have some kind of a drainage provided. So holes in the bottom of it so that the material, the excess water can drain out. You can put a bin on top of, you know, wood blocks or bricks or things like that over a pan and collect that effluent. Use it directly as a soil drench nutrient solution, you know, that you can use directly on potted plants or in the yard. So it's, you know, that we call that kind of like the compost tea that develops from this whole breakdown process.
Is there any concern for any bad pathogens that might be in there, or is this pretty clean?
It's pretty clean. If you keep it in the right temperature, you keep it moist but not too wet, and it stays aerobic in its decomposition, then you really won't get a lot of the molds and bacteria and other things that you worry about growing on food wastes. Some of that will develop, but it'll be primary decomposers that then the worms will work in concert with to break the material down, and it won't become a pathogenic problem.
Yeah. I've seen red worms composting in kitchens, and people have built a drawer.
Yeah,
that they just put all their stuff in, and then they can pull out what they need at the bottom, and so the worms are actually in the kitchen, and there's no smell. There's no smell to it because of that they're adding materials as needed and taking things out at the bottom. So
when processing right with the right recipe and the temperature and the moisture conditions, you keep it aerobic. You know, keep it oxygenated. Then the gases that come off really are only carbon dioxide and some minor gases that you can smell from the food, but you won't get the real smelly hydrogen sulfide and methane gas if you keep it oxygenated, which is nice. And those kinds of gases you can really pick up, and they're kind of the smelly ones that we don't want around.
Yeah.
So you'll get a quick indicator whether or not it's too wet. You know, if it needs to be separated out and and replenished with good bedding material and things like that.
Now, my friends in Cedar City, maybe it doesn't get quite as cold there as it does here, but I know that they've got theirs set up so that they don't get a whole lot out of them, of course, during the winter, but they are outside and they're somewhat protected, and they can't just go into the soil down below where they have them, but they come back each spring. So I think if you've got them protected enough, maybe you don't have to order them every
year.
You do.
And I've seen people, build soil mounds around the containers or put straw down in on top and over it and just let them sit.
Yeah.
Don't add any food during the winter because they're really not processing that much. but you certainly can keep them alive and for the most part, if you insulate them and keep them from getting too cold, just throwing them out in the garden soil is where we're talking about them kind of dying off. But if you keep them insulated, you can. Now, in the yard during the course of the spring and summer, it can get too hot for them too. And so you want to kind of keep them in an area where it stays reasonably shaded and not too hot, because the temperatures in these bins could, skyrocket during the summer to levels that would injure the worms as well. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about the bins then. So you've got these worms, they've come in. Can you just use a plastic tub that you would get? And then I've imagined you have to put holes in it.
Some of the tubs that you can buy that are already made are, they're dark in color to keep the sunlight out, which we can talk about here in a minute. But they've already got drainage holes in them and air holes, perforated into them for you. But if you just go and buy a regular, plastic tub at local stores or anything, you can drill some holes in the bottom for drainage and drill some holes in the sides for aeration. Don't snap the lids on tight when you do put things in and keep them loose at the top, and that'll still provide some air exchange in the bin as well. But try to use something that's not transparent, or at least it blocks out the light, because the skin of these worms is sensitive to light, and the light will drive them deeper into the material. And if you do that, they'll stay more in the bedding and not up into the food where you're trying to get them to process the waste. And so if you keep them dark, they will they'll do much better. They'll stay up in the active feeding areas and not try to escape the light and get deeper into the material. So.
And it's kind of like what was that movie, The Gremlins?
Bright light,
they didn't like the light. Well, yeah, it's the same thing. It doesn't really hurt them so much as it just tells them, hey, I'm exposed, and they try to get deeper. And you'll find that if it's too bright or too light in the container, that the worms will stay down in the bedding. And you'll say, well, what's wrong? Maybe I've not got the right stuff in there. And it's typically because they get too much light. So try to minimize the light. A lot of people will put them under their beds even and things like that, or in the kitchen, like you said, in a drawer where it's dark. And
what is this underneath the bed?
It seems kind of strange, but, you can do it just about anywhere if you keep the conditions right.
So what do they look like? I guess I should ask that question. So they're going to arrive in the mail, and how big are they compared to the regular night crawlers?
A little bit smaller than the bigger night crawlers we see typically, the mature ones in our yard. They're not as, necessarily round. They're a little bit smaller, but they're, 2-3 inches long when you'll get them. And, a good pencil width in girth and things like that. And they'll kind of have typically bands of color, they'll have dark red and buff colored bands, rings of color on their bodies. You'll see them and you'll say, okay, these are very different than the earthworms I typically see out in the yard. But and then they'll grow to mature, 3-4 inches in length and pretty chubby by the time they get fully fed. But they'll reproduce quite readily in good conditions.
And as far as vegetative matter is concerned, they don't care for onions and garlic as much, but they will break it down if that's all.
They will
there.
Break it down. Onions, garlic, shallots, things that have that. It's not so much the spiciness of the food that they avoid. It's the aromatics that come off of these different vegetables that kind of drive them off. So minimize any of that might be in the waste. You'll also notice that things like orange peel stick around much longer. And the reason is they don't have really aggressive mouth parts to really chew on the larger material. And so stuff that doesn't readily molder down a little bit gives them opportunities for attack.
So it has to
stick around.
Soften up quite
a
bit.
Yeah, it has to soften up. Or, you know, you can pulverize or grind those up and put them in, and that'll process much faster if you do.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about vermicomposting, or using worms to take care of your compost. And in studio with me today has been Grant Carden, who's USU's Extension Soil Specialist. Grant, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me on today's Zesty Garden. And we're looking at our segment of recommended houseplants. Shane Taylor from Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City is my guest. He's their horticultural specialist and buyer. And today we're going to look at pothos. And this is one that you sometimes see a lot in people's homes. Tends to take a little bit of a beating, especially when it comes to light. But you've got one here that's variegated, and it's just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, the one I've got here today in the studio, they call it the Enjoy, which is a miniature variegated pothos. It's a recent introduction. Pothos, yeah, you know, I'm always joking with our customers saying this is the plant you could probably run over with your car and it would survive. You could just take that one leaf that's left and stick it in water and off it would go again. They're a great plant. And one of the reasons they're so common is because they are so hardy, is they are a plant that is a must have. And if you look at some of the clean air literature about plants that are good at removing toxins from the air, pothos is going to be right up there at the top of the list. It is one of those plants that has gone under many studies to show the different things that it will pull out of the air. And they're amazing. They're great. You can put them in a wide range of light. They could sit in a sunny window. They can sit in a dark basement. They're just amazing.
So a dark basement would be like if it just had overhead fluorescent, that gives it enough light?
That would give it enough light. Of course, a good rule of thumb with pothos is the more variegation the leaf has, the more light it needs. And that seems a little backwards for people who are familiar with outdoor plants, because it's usually the more variegation, the more shade it needs. But for indoor plants, it's exactly the opposite. So if you've got a really light-colored leaf that with a lot of white in it, you know that they need a little bit brighter light. Whereas the pothos with the dark green leaf, the one they call the green jade, that can survive under artificial lighting and do great indefinitely, as long as it's being watered properly and cared for, they'll do great. Pothos does want to run, though. It'll start in its pot, and a lot of people don't realize that in order to keep it under control, you got to really chop at it, and you want
to
make
sure. So it's okay to cut off as it keeps running?
Oh, yeah. It's very recommended to keep your pothos pruned back, because it will put all its energy into one or two trailers, and it will go. And the pot that it was started in will then suddenly be an empty pot with a stem coming out. And then you'll see the foliage part of the plant will be 5-10 feet away, you know, up the window or up the down the bookshelf, wherever you set it. They've decided to start traveling. And it's very common for pothos out in nature to germinate possibly miles from where they die.
Wow.
Just because they travel, they run. So keeping them pruned back encourages them to stay thick and full and to put their growth into multiple different vines. So I prune mine back about once every 2 to 3 months. I'll take the longest 2 or 3 trailers and chop them back.
Okay, so you only keep about how many trailers altogether?
Well, actually, with the size of pothos I have, they probably have more than a dozen different trailers. But I'll look for the 3 longest trailers, and I'll cut them back. And then so 3 months later, I go to prune it again, and those that I've just cut back have now set off new offshoots and have started coming back from the center of the pot, and I'll take the next 3 longest trailers and cut them back.
So by the end of the year, you've pretty much gotten your whole pot.
Yep, and it's all fresh growth constantly coming off of the plant, and it's keeping it the right size for me, because I don't want it to get too huge. I don't really want it to grow in a big long line away from its container. I keep it hanging in my window, and I want it to look nice and full and healthy. So that's one of the ways of keeping it a little bit fuller.
This is really interesting information for me, because I had a pothos when we moved into our house 17 years ago, and I had it on the counter, and our kitchen is on the north side of the house. So there wasn't a lot of natural light coming in, and it just started looking what I call leggy. It was dropping. The ones that were coming out from the pot itself, there were no leaves on it. So it just wasn't looking very good. I mean, it sounds like to me, if I had just pruned those back, would it produce more once it's dropped leaves off?
Yeah, where you cut the stem back, it will produce new leaves at that point. So if you cut the stems back to just a few inches off the soil, if you follow those real long trailers up to the soil and make sure that you can see where the old leaves were, the old mm-hmm. nodes, and you want to leave at least a couple of those nodes because that's going to be where the new stem comes out of. And you cut it at that point, and sometimes one stem then will turn into two. Instead of having one trailer in that spot, you'll then have two. So it will keep it much fuller, much better looking if you keep them trimmed back on a regular basis. Plus, if you're a person who likes to propagate plants on your own, if you have friends that like plants, every time you cut one of those stems off, you can then take that stem, stick it in water, stick it in soil, and you've got a whole new pothos right there.
Wow, so they'll re-root.
They'll re-root very easily. Probably one of the easiest plants to get to root and to propagate that I can think of.
How long would you let them trail before you prune them back?
I let mine trail about 18 inches.
So not very much.
Not very much. But I have a smaller space. I don't want it to get too huge. My windows at my house are packed with plants, so all the plants have to share that light. I can't let my pothos take over, and it would. It's the opportunistic plant that will take over anywhere you put it.
A pothos, like the one you have here that's variegated, the more variegation or the more lighter colors in the leaves, the more light that it needs.
That's correct.
And the darker the leaf, the less light it needs. So if you live in a basement or just don't have a north exposure, find one that's darker.
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay, that sounds pretty easy. And keep it cut back to about 18 inches. And then what kind of soil do you put it in?
Just regular old potting soil. They're not very fussy about the soil that they go in. Make sure, just like any plant, that you never let them stand in water. If you are rooting them in water, of course, that's one thing, but you don't want soil to be submerged in water. They are easy. You water them about once a week. Check them about once a week, see if they need it or not. They can be like other plants where you can let the plant wilt slightly between watering, and when you water it will pop right back up.
Do they ever blossom?
You know, they do flower. Philodendrons all bloom. They bloom with that spathe and spadix flower, but it's not very common. I've seen one pothos flowering, and that was on a golf course in Hawaii, and I've never seen one in the shop or in my house ever bloom.
Okay. Well, Shane, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Shane Taylor is the horticultural specialist and buyer with Cactus and Tropicals, and our recommended house plant. This particular show is the pothos.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams, and I'm here today for Petals and Prose and another P word, which we're all grappling with right now, called pests in the garden. And I would like to share with you a reading about pests and guests in the garden from a wonderful Zen Buddhist friend of mine who is the author of Gardening at the Dragon's Gate. Her name is Wendy Johnson. And she's talking today, or she's writing, and I'm talking to you, what she said about gardening with all beings, which sounds wonderful and ooey-gooey, but turns out to be much more like all of us. So from her chapter here called Pest or Guest, Gardening with All Beings, she writes, "He was bent over the red Italian garlic bed, a properly dressed older man shaking his head and clucking in audible disapproval. He spotted me and straightened up, striding toward me with vigor and missionary purpose. Here it comes, I thought, as I braced myself for my least favorite question, which is, how do you get rid of your gophers? And he did say that. How do you get rid of your gophers? Said the righteous gentleman. Because you know they're taking down your entire garlic crop. Get rid of gophers, I thought. My garlic crop? Are you kidding? I wanted to shout, we don't get rid of anything at Green Gulch. We are the Universal Delicatessen, open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, year-round, a demilitarized zone for all besieged and hungry beings. But even as I formed this thought, I saw through it, because in fact, I did want to get rid of that single, tireless pocket gopher who was wreaking havoc in the garlic bed. And while I was at it, I would also have liked to abolish all the other uninvited guests feeding on the bounty of our garden. While my friends back in the Zendo ponder pithy spiritual questions, I ask myself, what is a pest? Or what is a disease? And more specifically, what's the best way to deal with the gophers and the rosy apple aphids in the fruit tree beds? In the safe shelter of the meditation hall, I even occasionally see myself as a kind of a pest. I plague raccoons and deer, pursue spit bugs and flea beetles, and I plot their demise. I, too, am a kind of invasive creature, an exotic in California. Hailing from New England, I have replaced pristine native bogs of wild horsetail and stands of California nettles with row after row of introduced red Russian kale and clove-scented stock flowers from southern Europe. Over and over, I am humbled by how quickly my insights into interbeing are burned off and vaporized by the fire of righteous indignation as one little pocket gopher surges boldly through a winter planting of red Italian garlic. I have a 100-year-old friend who's been a passionate fan and supporter of the Green Gulch Garden for decades. One spring morning, I happened upon Charlotte, hovering over a newly emerged bed of spring anemones. Hundreds of crimson, dark purple, and pale cream anemone buds were lifting their heads from out of their winter reservoir of pale green fern-like foliage. Charlotte raised herself slowly, slowly from the spell of the flowers, and came to the surface of the garden for air. "This garden must be responded to," she whispered to me urgently. Unwanted creatures are forever arriving at the garden gate and requiring response. In order to respond to an importuning visitor, you must first get out of the way and drop your notions of what your garden is. The word respond comes from the Latin spondere, to pledge, to espouse, to sponsor. Pledging and promising to meet your garden and all visitors is core to every gardener's life. Good pest response depends on merging these styles of gardening. If you over-fertilize, your plants will be pumped and succulent, announcing themselves loudly to visiting pests or to the disease spores of mold, fungus, and other pathogens. If you under-fertilize and worry about pest attack all the time, your garden will also suffer, and so will you. There is a middle way between these two extremes that allows relaxation and enjoyment of the garden. The key to finding and keeping this balance is open-minded awareness, not control. No matter how much you want to have just the right guests come to your house, uninvited pests will also arrive hungry and long-fanged at your garden gate. Once you stop, look, and listen long enough to recognize that you have a pest or a destructive disease in your garden, sink down to ground level and notice what exactly is happening to your plants. There is a sensitive balance here between monitoring mindfully and waiting too long, so take Goethe's advice. Do not hurry. Do not rest. And respond in a timely fashion. In the early 1990s, the Saratoga area of Northern California had a very dry winter. That reminds me of the kind of dry winter we had here in Utah this year. She continues, as the summer heat came on, the huge heritage oak that is the centerpiece of the organic Sasso herb garden began to drop its leaves. Lewis and Virginia Sasso discovered that they had a full-on infestation of California oak moth caterpillars in their magnificent oak. Their neighbors complained of the same pest and immediately began to spray chemicals on their trees to kill the caterpillars of the moth before their live oaks were defoliated. Lewis and Virginia elected to wait, not only out of reluctance to spray chemicals, but also because of their familiarity with the life cycle and the effects of the oak moth. The Sassos felt sure there was a hot summer ahead. They watched and monitored every day just how much the caterpillars were eating, and they noticed that there was a natural tapering off of leaf fall as the insects began to pupate. Because they had been sprayed with pesticide, their neighbors' oak trees were covered with glossy new leaves. While their moth caterpillars had reduced the foliage of the Sasso oak tree by a good third. Their once mighty oak looked wan and ragged compared to the full canopied oaks next door. Still, the Sassos chose not to spray. By late August of that year, many of the other grand old oaks that had been sprayed began to wither and die because they had far too many leaves to maintain in the intense summer heat. However, the Sasso's oak had been stripped down just enough by the oak leaf caterpillars to survive the incandescent heat, a testimony to the patience, forbearance, and biological acumen of both the oak moth and the 70-year-old gardeners, who neither hurried nor waited in responding to their garden. In responding to pests and disease in your garden, keep in mind the basic teaching of the Buddha that everything changes all the time. Combining that with a reminder from the modern naturalist and conservationist John Muir that everything in the universe is hitched to everything else. Follow your affection as you garden, and when you meet a pest, eye to complex eye or shoulder to thorax, consider that this very spit bug doing the backstroke through a froth of expectorated foam may have been your mother lifetimes ago, or from a more rationalist perspective, is now your cousin, and you share a common parentage. Fold yourself in with the lot of all the shady and noble pests and guests that also love your healthy and diverse garden. Join the party. Your very life and good fortune as a gardener depend on this integrated relationship and on giving up a measure of control in favor of responding to your garden with a playful, observant, and wide pest-integrating mind. I've been reading to you from Gardening at the Dragon's Gate by Wendy Johnson. Thanks for listening. I'm Nancy Williams, in for the Zesty Garden and Petals and Prose and Pests. Until next time.